3.5 and 4 megahertz. I think I stayed within the limit of better than 2 to 1, Dick. Over.
Now, this is a turnstile where you've got two dipoles at right angles to each other. Were the two dipoles both at tuned to 3750, or was one long and one shorter? Over to you, Mel.
I should say at 40 meters. I did not do this on 80 meters. I'm just doing some calculations here to see if we can. I would assume what you would do, let's think. I would say that you would make both dipoles the same length, Dick. I would think you just about have the same dipoles because basically you'd be going from the center band, from the center to the low end of the band, and from the center to the high end of the band. I think that would be the correct way to analyze it. I would agree, Dick. Figuring that the how much degradation would you have between isolation of between the two ports? I'm just trying to figure this out, Dick. Over.
If the two dipoles are truly at right angles to each other, they are thoroughly isolated, 20 or 30 dB apart. Therefore, each one is, let's say, a 70-ohm load, and by way of the Wilkinson hybrid, you're feeding a pair of 70-ohm loads, although some balancing action is required here because the Wilkinson is basically a coax-type balun, not a twin lead-type balun. So maybe you had some ferrites in there in just the right place. But a pair of orthogonal dipoles, 50 ohms each, shouldn't have had a significant difference in Vizwar bandwidth compared to one single Yagi, one single dipole, I'm trying to say. They're two thoroughly independent antennas, each one acting the same, impedance-wise versus frequency. So unless you made one long and one short, I'm having a little trouble seeing how the Wilkinson plus turnstile would give you extra bandwidth. Over to you, Mel.
That OCF turnstile.
Somebody want to make a comment?
So somebody said an OCF stem turnstile. You're going to have to tell us what OCF stands for.
2 RSL, off-center fed dipole. And just hypothetically, how would that fit into the turnstile equation?
Believe it or not, Frank, almost no difference. As you use an off-center fed dipole, your feed impedance becomes higher and higher, and you have a greater and greater need for a good balancing structure, a current balance structure. So if the center of the dipole is 70 ohms, and you start moving off to one side as to the way you feed it, you start seeing 80, 90, 100 ohms, and depending on how far you go, you can make it go up to 2,000 ohms as you feed it really close to one end. So the off-center feeding with proper balancing doesn't stop the fact that each dipole is at right angles to each other and therefore thoroughly isolated. And the off-center feeding with proper balancing just raises the load impedance. So I don't think that's going to do it. Now back to you, Mel.
I think you're correct, Dick. This is K2KEY. I'm just thinking about this. With a Wilkinson type of hybrid, and using this type of configuration, I would say you'll easily have better than a 20 dB isolation between the two antennas. And that means that, you're not going to really have, it's hard to say your load is going to be a pure 50 ohms. I think that you're most likely, self going to find a perfect 50 ohm load there. You may have some, degrading, maybe a number of dB grading it at that point, but I think it should work and give you a fairly good coverage of the 80 meter band as it did when I did it on 40, Dick. Over.
Okay, let me backtrack a little bit here, Mel. A Wilkinson power divider is a power divider. If you've got 100 watts coming out of the transmitter, going into the Wilkinson divider, coming out of the two ports of the Wilkinson are a pair of 50 watt in-phase signals. The dipoles themselves at right angles are isolated from each other. So if the two dipoles are identical in length, and I'll admit in the real world, one dipole is going to be parallel to the house and one is going to be perpendicular to the house, and therefore the dipoles are going to see slightly different environment. That's a complicating factor. But if this was all done over flat terrain, and the two dipoles are equal in length, then I can't see how there's going to be any difference in bandwidth of the Wilkinson plus two orthogonal dipoles, as opposed to directly feeding one single dipole, on the assumption you're doing proper balloning. Now, I'll admit that without proper balloning, where you're starting to get currents flowing down the outside of the coax cables, depending on the length of the cables, life can get complicated. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Yeah, Roger. This is K2KEY. I'm trying to remember, really, the in and out of using, the turnstile antenna classically is just two cross, two dipoles crossing each other. And I think when I did the plot that time on the fifth chart, I think that what I'm trying to remember, off the top of my head, because it did show, I think I did have a calculated 20 dB, I did. Remember, I had a good, at least 20 dB calculation over the entire band, Dick, using the Wilkinson hybrid. And I think it gave me, if I remember correctly, a very good a flat response over it. I believe I used a 100 ohm balancing resistor, if I'm not mistaken. Gee, I'm trying to recall. It's quite a number of years ago, but we're dealing with a signal traveling basically, I guess, 180 degrees out of phase to begin with, and so basically, I would think that we should be able. I think I should calculate it here. I think we should be able to see at least a 20 dB isolation there, Dick. Over.
I can see another thing going on here, Mel. First of all, a properly constructed Wilkinson hybrid for full isolation requires a floating 100 ohm resistor to be placed between the two outputs. If you don't do that, you just don't get as much isolation. But because your two dipoles are very well isolated, that need of that 100 ohm resistor is not significant. Now, if you were feeding the turnstile in a conventional manner, which means one antenna had a 90 degree longer length of cable than the other, and if that cable was made out of 50 or 70 ohms, now you get some funny impedance inversion of that cable versus frequency that you don't on the other. Now I see a mechanism by which greater bandwidth could occur. So was this a full 90 degree differential fed turnstile antenna, as opposed to just the two outputs of the Wilkinson hybrid directly feeding the dipoles with equal lengths? Back to you, Mel.
Remember correctly, that's the way it is. You brought up a good point, because we do have to think of one more thing. The 100 ohm resistor. So what we're going to do, we're going to find out that that resistor is going to take some of the power away. Now let me concentrate on what we're doing here. I guess that resistor, now, could we be without that resistor? No, we can't be without the resistor. So we have to put a high power, you have to use a high power non-inductive resistor. And it's all going to be dissipated. A lot of that is all being dissipated into the 100 ohm balancing resistor. So you will not have any. That's right. The reflected power will not arrive back at the source because the 100 ohm resistor is that's where it's being dissipated in. Correct? Over.
There's a yes and a no to that. If it was a conventional quadrature hybrid, then the reflected power would possibly be absorbed by the resistor. That's the so-called balanced amplifier technique. But a Wilkinson hybrid, because it gives you two equal amplitude, equal phase signals, under normal conditions, there is 0 volts across that 100-ohm resistor. That 100-ohm resistor only comes into play if there is cross-coupling between the loads of the output of the Wilkinson. In your particular case, where the dipoles are thoroughly orthogonal, they are thoroughly isolated. Therefore, I don't see a mechanism by which there should be any voltage across that 100-ohm resistor. But if you did add an extra 90 degrees or quarter wavelength of cable to one of the dipoles, so then you're feeding it in a true turnstile manner. Now, as you go up in frequency and one dipole becomes inductive, because you see the other dipole through a quarter wavelength of impedance inverting cable, it looks capacitive. Therefore, it will be more broadbanded if it is a true turnstile. And now there's a slight need for that 100-ohm resistor. But not much of one. I think you could leave out the 100-ohm resistor and nothing bad would happen. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I think you're right. This is K2KEY. I don't think that 100-ohm resistor in a case like this is really going to make any impressive changes in the antenna system. I would bet that you could leave out the that resistor, because if you look at it, that resistor basically is going to come into its own at the edge of the band, Dick, as I see it. So, I would say that maybe in this case you'll leave out that 100-ohm resistor. Now, I know Wilkinson, basically, Wilkinson hybrids really were basically, being a, when you were putting them into a situation, I don't think that the Wilkinson was really, a system that was really apropos to this. I think it was more or less, something that was used as, a power divider or combiner, I guess, at microwave frequency. So does it work classically at HF, low frequency HF, as it would at microwave frequency, Dick, over?
I think the answer is absolutely, Mel. Almost anything that works at microwave works better at lower frequencies. Almost any technique you want to use that you perfect with lumped components at low frequencies on a bench become more difficult to implement when you go up to microwave frequencies. So going up is a difficult direction. With rare exception, coming down is easy. So as I see it, when you go up in frequency and each dipole becomes inductive because you're seeing through one of them through a extra quarter wavelength of cable, which impedance inverts, that inductance appears as a capacitance. And now your two Wilkinson outputs, one is capacitive, one is inductive. I'm not sure you need a Wilkinson. If those two points are connected directly together, make the 100-ohm resistor 0 ohms, because one is going capacitive and one's going inductive, and therefore they tend to cancel, that's going to be a broadbanding technique right there. You could also not use a Wilkinson. Use a quadrature hybrid. The quadrature hybrid gives you the 90 degrees of phase shift. Therefore, equal lengths of cable out of the quadrature hybrid to the two dipoles, and any reflected power from the dipoles would now end up in the quadrature hybrid 50-ohm termination. And there are ways of making a quadrature hybrid at HF frequencies with transformer-like structures, with toroids. In fact, the directional wattmeter that's in the antenna handbook really is a quadrature hybrid. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Another good point you just brought up. In the there's a company that markets phased vertical array harnesses. Now, using a in the phased vertical system, they use that propagation. They have these harnesses they sell you that so you can put these phased verticals driving to drive these phased verticals. Maybe that is another way of going. In other words, I only thought of the Wilkinson because, you know, with the Wilkinson, you've got very good, basically, you know, way of splitting. You know, is the attenuation, I guess, between the two loads. I guess the attenuation, you know, between the input and the output of each load will be at least, with Wilkinson, around at least 3 dB. So that's why I would assume, I thought that's why you needed the, you know, the 100 ohm resistor. So the, because half of it's got to be dissipated into that 3 dB. It's half of it. That's what it is. It goes into that balancing resistor. But you say no. So how about going to a phasing type, driving a phase, like driving phase vertical stick over?
Yeah, once again, Lou, I mean, here we go. Now, under normal conditions, the two outputs of a Wilkinson hybrid are equal in amplitude and equal in phase. Therefore, under normal conditions, there is 0 volts across the 100 ohm resistor, and it's not dissipating any power. And in the full turnstile with the extra quarter wavelength of cable on one of the legs, I'll admit that that gets disturbed. But I think you could save the length of cable, but not using a Wilkinson, using a quadrature hybrid. And there's ways you can build a quadrature hybrid out of toroids. Just beef up the directional watt meter you've got in the antenna handbook, and you've got a quadrature hybrid. And that gives you two output signals equal in amplitude, 90 degrees apart, and now you're filling, you're using the antenna as a full turnstile in the conventional manner. If you view that antenna top view, it would be giving you circular polarization. When you view it from the horizon, those two dipoles do not fight each other. At one instant of time, during the RF cycle, you're transmitting a signal east and west. A quarter wavelength later, the peak of power is hitting the other dipole, and you're transmitting maximum power north and south. So what a turnstile really does is it takes the peak of the antenna pattern and sweeps it around the horizon 360 degrees per RF cycle. So therefore, it is an antenna that equally covers every single azimuth direction. It has no null point, so to speak. It's got a fraction of a dB of wow to it. Because in one case, you're looking at the dipoles broadside, and in another angle, you're looking at the two dipoles at a 45-degree angle from you. And you get a little bit of difference of gain because of that. But it's not significant. It's darn close to a good circular polarized antenna. Top view and bottom view. And from the horizon, it is a sweeping azimuth antenna. I think it's a good way to go for a broadbanding.
Repeater, timeout.
You're broadbanding both in azimuth as well as in frequency. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Dick, this is K2KY. One thing bothering me here. Let's back up with the Wilkinson hybrid. Maybe I'm misunderstanding something because, you know, I'm reflecting back in my mind. Let's take it step by step because I think we're leaving out something here. Does not a special case occur when two identical loads are driven through this hybrid? So one load driven directly from the hybrid output and the other load driven through the quarter wavelength cable. Now, if the loads are not 50 ohms, follow slowly. If the loads, I'm making little sketches here, if the loads are not 50 ohms, there will be a reflection at the load back towards the source. Right? There will be a reflection, of the load back to the source. And since one of the lows is 90 degrees farther away, right, then the reflection coming back will be a total of 180 degrees out of phase with the reflection that is directly connected to the load. I think I got that pretty straight in my mind. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
I think not, Mel. You may be confusing Wilkinson with quadrature hybrid. I'm first going to describe a Wilkinson hybrid. A Wilkinson hybrid has a common input port where the semiconductor of the input connector goes to a pair of semiconductors of 70 ohm cable. The shields of the 70 ohm cables are grounded. Each 70 ohm cable is a 90 degree or quarter wavelength long. At the output end of those two quarter wavelengths of cable is output connector number one and connector number two. And again, the shields are grounded on the far end. So, one input common connector feeds a pair of equal length 70 ohm cables to a pair of 50 ohm output connectors. Now, let's see why that's a perfectly impedance-balanced power divider. Let's make sure that one of the output connectors, in my example, has a 50 ohm load. That 50 ohm load is fed with a upper piece of 70 ohm cable, quarter wavelength long. 50 ohms, 70 ohm cable, quarter wavelength long, input end looks like 100 ohms. So when you do it on each leg, at the input common connector, you're paralleling a pair of 100 ohm loads. 200 ohm loads in parallel makes 50 ohms. So now you see why it perfectly impedance balances while it does power dividing. A simple T connector would really give you a pair of 50 ohm resistors in parallel, and you would see as an input common port 25 ohms. You get around that problem with the Wilkinson by the 70 ohm quarter wavelength long piece of the cable acting as an impedance inverter, making 50 look like 100 on each leg. Are you with me so far? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Okay, let me simplify it for those who are listening so they won't, you know, lose us. What Dick is saying, you say correct. Make believe you have a 50, you draw a triangle. Draw a triangle at, say, the apex. Draw an equilateral triangle, in fact. And at the apex, any apex of this triangle, put that as your 50 ohm source. Each leg now coming out from that point will be a quarter wavelength of 70 ohm line. That two equals 70 ohm lines, Dick is mentioning. Now across the third leg of that triangle will be 100 ohms. You substitute 100 ohms. So that's what it's going to look like. So now at that point, on each point where that 100 ohm resistor meets that 70, the quarter wavelength 70 ohm line, you will have load 1, 50 ohms, and load 2 on the other side, what we call nominal load of 50 ohms. That will be load 1 on one side of the resistor and load 2 on the other side of the resistor. Is that what you're trying to say, Dick, over?
You've got it, Mel. That's exactly the way it works. Now you're about to ask, why does the 100 ohm resistor give you isolation? And the isolation is between the two output connectors. There is no isolation per se between the output connectors and the common input connector. But if I pour a signal into output connector number one, that signal I'm pouring into output connector number one splits in two directions. One direction is going through the 100 ohm resistor to the output connector number two. The other direction, the signal flows down 70 ohm cable number one, jumps over the input common connector, and goes down 70 ohm cable number two. That total pass to the apex and back down is a half wavelength. So you got one signal, it's a half wavelength longer going through the cables. You got the other signal of essentially zero length going through the 100 ohm resistor. Those two signals are 180 degrees out of phase. They combine at connector number two and cancel. So that gives you an understanding of why the 100 ohm resistor creates isolation between the two output connectors. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, let me again put this in some other words. What Dick is saying then, since the power going into the input of the hybrid is being split, in other words, a 3 dB loss between the input and the each output. So power coming in either one of the two low ports is actually being attenuated by 3 dB because half the power is going back to the source and is also half is being dissipated by the 100 ohm resistor in this case. Is that way you're trying to say it, Dick? Over.
Good guess, but absolutely not. The Wilkinson power divider is a lossless power divider. I'll admit that each of the outputs are 3 dB weaker than the common input, but there's two of them. If I add them back together in power, whatever power I start off with, I end up with. If my common port has 100 watts, each output connector will get 50 watts. 50 watts times 2, I've still got 100 watts of output. Assuming my 70 ohm cables are lossless and there's no voltage across the 100 ohm resistor, there is no mechanism of dissipation. I've also got a 50 ohm input impedance and a pair of 50 ohm output impedances. There is no impedance mismatch. So the thing has no vis-wir. It is a true power divider. It is not a dissipator. You could call it 3 dB of loss if you're naive to each of the output connectors. It is simply dividing the power and not losing any of it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
As I may, I put it a little bit wrong way, but yes, I understand what you're saying. The power coming into either one of the two loads, you could say, is attenuated because by 3 dB, half the power, which goes back to the source, but the other half comes back again, so that's it's an interesting effect. In fact, if you want to look at it, it can make a perfect match this way. I think you can make, this is like a, I think you got a, I think it's a match better than some dummy load, Dick, if you want to look at it, because I could see that with that 100 ohm resistor, that, this should work. This should work quite well because you have the two antennas, and being that the loads are actually 90 degrees apart, essentially, so there should be almost lossless situation. Am I correct? Over, almost like a perfect dummy load. Over.
I disagree again, Mel. There is no 90 degree difference between the two output loads. That signal that you apply to the common port flows through a pair of equal length 70 ohm cables to a pair of outputs. Those two output signals are equal in power and equal in phase. So under normal conditions, the signal goes through the Wilkinson hybrid in one direction only and never flows back. And there is no flow between the two output connectors. The 100 ohm resistor sees 0 volts all the time between the two ends. With reference to ground, there's voltage. But that 100 ohm resistor is a floating 100 ohm resistor. So under normal conditions, with a pair of 50 ohm output loads, the power flows down through that Wilkinson hybrid in one direction once and never reflects. This signal I talked about that flows around the circle is only a returning signal to one of the output ports, and I was explaining the mechanism of isolation to the other output port. but that's a reflected signal from the loads. Under normal circumstances, that power flows in one direction once and is simply power divided. Over to you, Bill.
WB2EAB with a very quick comment.
You got it, Ed.
I'm not sure how germane it is to you and Mel, but people listening may have this question. I've noticed a lot of people don't realize this. When you use any kind of a power divider and any kind of an antenna, no matter how simple or how sophisticated, the idea is get back. They recombine out in the far field, out a mile or two away. You get full power back. Dick?
Good point. You don't violate conservation of aim. If I had two separate Yagis being fed with a Wilkinson hybrid, and I start off with 100 watts, and I put 50 watts into Yagi number one and 50 watts into Yagi number two, out in free space when those two signals combine, I've got 100 watts being radiated. However, because it's being radiated by two antennas instead of one antenna, I do have twice as much gain. So, if each antenna had 10 dB of gain, the combination of the two antenna has 13 dB of gain. And the 100 watts I put in, coming out of one antenna with 10 dB of gain, would have been 1,000 watts of ERP. When I combine the two antennas with 13 dB of gain and 50 watts going into each one, go through the whole mathematics, I've got 2,000 watts of ERP instead of 1,000 watts of ERP. I will admit that one would require a couple of extra steps to confirm it, but I wonder if you agree with that one, Ed. Over to you, Ed, K2LIW.
Yes, you just have to be perfectly clear not to get confused with gain as in power gain like in amplifiers, and not confusing that with an antenna gain, which is a focusing, which means you're focusing the beam in hopefully the right direction and attenuating it in what are hopefully the wrong directions.
Give that man a cigar. Because those two Yagis in my examples are stacked side by side, my horizontal beam width is a lot more narrow than it used to be with one single Yagi. So I've got a little bit more flashlight-like focusing action going on here. That's where the antenna gain is coming from. So each antenna gives me 50 watts of applied power. That becomes 500 watts of EIRP, but the extra gain of the total array gives me this 2,000 watts of ERP as opposed to 1,000 watt of ERP if I put all of the power into one Yagi. I will admit now that when you combine the power in space, you gotta be careful. Human beings always think in watts, and we want to combine watts. Mother Nature always thinks in voltage, or she calls it field voltage. So you take the voltage out of antenna number one, sensed a mile away, in units of volts per meter, and you take the voltage of antenna number two, sensed a mile away, in volts per meter, and because those two patterns are overlapping in the far field, you add the voltage of signal number one and the voltage of signal number two before you go into that receiving antenna a mile away. If you didn't realize that and you just add up wattages, you would say, hey, there's no improvement. Why in the heck are we doing this? WB2EAV for any comments. K2LIW.
I'm fine, Dick.
Okay, I think Howie's got a question on all this. Go ahead, Howie.
If you take the hybrid, and you put two amplifiers and the two outputs, don't you get 3 dB gain? Because 200 watts, you put them in the two outputs, and the timing will get 200 watts.
In the case of amplifiers, going through a Wilkinson hybrid backwards, yes, you do add power. However, deep inside of the Wilkinson hybrid, where I've got these 70 ohm pieces of cable that are acting as impedance inverter, I could analyze it again as a voltage adding process. And if I did it right, I'd come up with the correct answer. So if you ask me, inside of that Wilkinson, are we adding power or adding volts? The answer is yes. I know that's not an easy one. Over to you, Howie.
Okay, the reason why you don't add power is because you can't add power in a nonlinear function. So you must add both of this. So you have to look at it in a nodal analysis format, am I correct? Because you're dealing power in that type of configuration, dealing in a nonlinear function, am I correct, Dick?
You got it. Professor Seidman would be proud of you. You add voltages inside of linear devices. To add powers, there are times when, if you're a little bit lucky, it works. But when you really get down to the nitty-gritty, Mother Nature and all of your circuits add and subtract voltages in a vector manner. In other words, amplitude and phase has to be properly accounted for when you add those voltages together. Hey, Mel, look what you got us into here tonight. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. I'm not finished yet. I want to ask a question that's come to mind. What happens if the loads are not 50 ohms? What's there now? Let's take this step by step. We're not dealing with a 50 ohm load now. What if we have now a different load? Wouldn't there be a reflection from the load back to the source, Dick? Let's just take a very slow step. Am I correct? Well, let's put this hypothetically. We have now a load that is not 50 ohms, so we have a reflection back to the source. Follow so far, over.
Yes, I see where you're going, and you're absolutely right. Now, in order for it to be simple, step by step, let me start off with a 100-watt transmitter going into the common port of a Wilkinson hybrid. And through output port number one, I've got 50 watts, and output port number two, I've got 50 watts. And if I terminate both of those with 50 ohm load resistor, all the power goes into the two load resistors, and I never see any of it back. Now let me make each load resistor a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, like 25 ohms. So each load resistor is a 25 ohm load resistor, which means 1/3 of the voltage is reflected back. 1/3 of the voltage from load number one, and 1/3 of the voltage from load number two. And by the way, a 2-to-1 VISWR gives you 9.5 dB of reflection coefficient. Those two 9.5 dB reflection coefficient signals from load number one and load number two now flow back through the quadrature hybrid and recombine at the common port. Because each of these loads were equally mismatched, all voltages at output port one and output two are always equal to each other. So again, the 100 ohm resistor sees no power. It's got voltage on it with reference to ground, but it's a floating 100 ohm resistor, and there's no differential voltage across the 100 ohm resistor. So all that power flows back to the common port. Therefore, the common port transmitter sees a 2-to-1 VISWR. So I've got a pair of 2-to-1 VISWR loads. The transmitter will see 2-to-1. That's the first step in going from the ideal world to a possible real world. Are you with me so far, Mel? K2KEY, K2RAW?
I believe. That's what I'm alluding to. Now, would you agree now, since one of the loads is actually 90 degrees further away, that the reflection coming back will be a total of 100 degrees out of phase with the reflection from the directly connected load. Is that correct? Over.
What you said would be absolutely true if we were using a quadrature hybrid. This is a Wilkinson hybrid. However, because our Wilkinson hybrid is not feeding a pair of 50 ohm loads, it's feeding a turnstile antenna, and one of the dipoles of the turnstile antenna has an extra 90 degrees of cable. So, could you say that the reflection from antenna number one compared to the reflection of antenna number two, because of the 90 degrees of difference going to antenna number one, and now you're reflecting back through that 90 degrees, that the two reflected signals will be 180 degrees out of phase with reference to each other. And now the 100 ohm balancing resistor is going to see some power and have the opportunity to absorb it. So because of the way we're feeding this turnstile antenna, we have some of the properties of a quadrature hybrid. The big magic about a quadrature hybrid, if I was building a balanced amplifier, which really means a pair of equal amplifiers, is that as long as the amplifiers are matched, the reflected powers from the two amplifiers being equal to each other come back through the quadrature hybrid, experience another 90 degrees of phase shift equaling a total of 180. Therefore, the reflected power at the common input port gets canceled, and the reflected power at the terminating 50 ohm resistor of the quadrature hybrid sees all the power. So the magic of a quadrature fed balanced amplifier is that as long as the two amplifiers are equal to each other, you've got a beautiful input S11 or VisWarm of the network at essentially all frequencies where the quadrature hybrid is behaving correctly. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly, that's what I was getting down to. Basically, I'll put it in other words, I think what you said. The reflected waves are thus equal and out of phase. So the power, but the power summing action of the Wilkinson will cause them to cancel out. Okay? So you say, oh, well, where's the power going then? And that is the beautiful part. The power is being dissipated into the 100 ohm balancing resistor. So none of the reflected power is actually being, will arrive back at the source. Correct, Dick?
I think that's essentially true. However, when you're using the Wilkinson to feed a turnstile, and now you're at off-center frequency, where the antenna presents some standing wave ratio, you're dissipating your reflected power in that 100 ohm resistor. If the 100 ohm resistor wasn't there, and if the two output ports were directly connected together with a 0 ohm resistor, because one antenna is presenting a capacitive impedance, and the other antenna is presenting an inductive impedance, they will tend to cancel. And now you've got nearly a perfect input standing wave ratio and no dissipated power. So when feeding a turnstile that has an extra quarter wavelength of cable from a Wilkinson hybrid, there is some advantage in making that 100 ohm floating resistor 0 ohms. Ain't that crazy? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. This is K2KEY. That's the beautiful part of it. I'm just thinking about it. You actually will wind up with a perfect, apparent, very good match. So this is what I was thinking about, because there's no chance that the loads are going to be exact. There's where the problem is going to be. I can say, you know, on the best circumstances. In fact, another part of another question here was how many different bends can you make in a dipole And what is the effect as you keep bending it different ways, going zigzagging and all? And I ran up against basically, you know, trying this the same thing with a 160-meter dipole. And if you look down from outer space, it looks like a big V with the two two legs of the Z about 65 feet each, and then there's 120-foot, the cross arm, and then another 65 feet. So, I mean, how much can you bend the dipole? This is the question before it just goes completely out of use. So I think it can be infinite. Am I correct? Over.
Okay, there are two subjects on the table here, Mel. Let me finish up on the first one. If I put a 100 ohm resistor in the output of the Wilkinson hybrid, I yank it away and put a 0 ohm resistor there. As I sweep in frequency and one dipole becomes inductive and one becomes capacitive, you would say the capacitive inductive reactances cancel. They don't completely cancel. They tend to cancel. You go through the exact mathematics of it, and you'll find that the capacitive reactants and inductive reactants are close, but not a perfect match. So it's going to be a good match, but not a perfect match. It's worth experimenting. Now, when it comes to zigzagging the dipole, common sense would lead you to believe that each bend is going to give you some kind of loss, and whether the bends go left and right, up and down, 45 degree and whatever, you're going to get different performances. Good common sense. Ain't true. Chu and Wheeler, Harold Wheeler, roughly 1947, and an Oriental man named Mr. Chu, each wrote separate articles that year, which are called the Chu-Wheeler Criteria. And what the Chu-Wheeler Criteria tells you is that as you physically decrease the volume of an antenna by zigzagging it, curving it, coiling it, doing all kinds of things, crumpling it, whatever, the Chu-Wheeler Criteria allows you to calculate the volume of the resulting antenna and what bandwidth you're going to be left with. As the volume of the antenna gets smaller and smaller because of your size-decreasing techniques, whether you do it with loading coils at the bottom or the middle, or top-loading cap, what are they called now? Top-hat capacitors at the tips, no matter what technique you use for decreasing the physical size of the antenna, you're lowering its volume. And the Chu-Wheeler Criteria allows you to relate volume of antenna to Q. And the bottom line is, as the antenna gets smaller and smaller, the Q goes up, or in other words, the bandwidth gets smaller and smaller. So the antenna does not stop working. Joe recognized the antenna doesn't stop working. The efficiency does not change when you go lower in size, just that it becomes more and more narrow band and becomes more and more difficult to impedance match it. The reactive component goes, capacitance starts getting very high, the radiation resistance starts getting very low, so impedance matching is difficult. But an infinitesimal dipole properly constructed can have 100% efficiency. It may only be 5 kilohertz wide, but it's going to radiate like a banshee. And the total pattern change is small. You lose 0.4 dB, 0.4 tenths of a dB. 4 tenths of a decibel is what you lose because of pattern modification. The donut becomes a little bit fatter. I'm trying to remember what article I was reading in the last 2 days that made that very clear. Oh, yes. It's the new antenna book that's online, which I can tell you about that. Let's see what Joe's got to say. W2LYY, K2LIW.
I had a question on a different subject, so when you're done with this subject, I'll ask that question. If there's enough time in the tech neck.
Yeah, it's getting a little bit tight. I know we're going to make it. Over to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I'm very interested in hearing this, Dick, but okay. Basically, let's just sum this up, that There's no such thing as a perfect circuit. That's what I think. That's the answer. And there is going to be, you know, you've got to have some reduction in isolation with anything, you know, when you're using especially two load ports. And it'd be obvious that only if everything was perfect, you know, the perfect design of both antennas on the same frequency and everything, transmission lines and everything were right, and the right exact right phase shift and everything. Even so, you will get, a very good coverage of the 80 meter band by this method, and I don't think you're going to have to worry really about there may be some degrading there, but I don't think it'd be more than, I don't know, what would possibly be the final word, the degradation between, say, the isolation of the ports. Dick, how many dBs possibly could you lose over?
Well, hold on now. In many cases, you want port 1 and port 2 going to two separate circuits to be isolated from each other. So you would use the full-blown Wilkinson hybrid with a 100-ohm resistor. In the case of our turnstile antenna, we have no reason to demand isolation between the east-west dipole and the north-south dipole. If some of the reflected energy from the east-west dipole gets re-radiated by the north-south dipole, that's going to make Mel and Dick very happy. We don't demand isolation. We demand the exact opposite of isolation. We want them to be coupled. Any reflected energy from one, I want it to be radiated by the other. So don't fight for isolation. We're using the Wilkinson hybrid as a power divider to feed this thing. We're not requiring it to have isolation. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, I was just thinking in the reason of using a Wilkinson type of divider in phase vertical antennas, you know, the in this case, like you say, the turnstile be beneficial, you know, if both of them are working. In fact, it would be ideal if they both work equally, you know, situation on 80 meters, because basically this is what you want it for. But I was thinking more of in the using it in a driving phase vertical, Dick. All right, listen, it's getting late. We'll pick up the other station, see what you can help him with, and we can continue some other time. This is K2KEY.
Well, I wouldn't worry about the isolation of a stacked vertical antenna being fed with a Wilkinson hybrid. Again, the cross-coupling may not be bad, but we'll get into that later. Let's see what Joe would like to know. You got it, Joe.
Maybe this question has a five-minute answer. Maybe it has more of an answer. Maybe it's less of an answer. I don't know. Okay. You talked about different various things, emitters and so forth, going up the microwave frequencies and so forth. What is the highest frequency that has actually been produced by man? That's, I guess, maybe the first part of the question. And what is the second part of the question? Is what is the highest possible frequency that can be, period? I know you go into the frequency range of light, X-ray, cosmic rays, gamma rays, and so forth. Is there anything above that, or is it just that we can't measure anything above that to know if something can exist up that high in wavelength?
The man who held the distance record in the United States for the 243 gigahertz band is Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, a pretty good friend of mine. Whenever you get an email from Tom, at the bottom of the email, it says, no frequency is too high. I jumped on that bandwagon, and now I put on the bottom of many of my emails, no frequency is high enough. Now, I know of mankind using radio-like frequency at 2 or 3 terahertz. That's 2 or 3,000 gigahertz, which is 2 or 3 million megahertz. So 2 or 3 terahertz is essentially the upper end of the band where you can buy components that use radio techniques. But you're about to ask the question, what's above that? And the answer is far infrared. We got all kinds of lasers that generate far infrared, near infrared, optical, ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, near X-ray, far X-ray, and cosmic rays. So, what's the highest frequency? Cosmic rays. I'll admit you're not using a coherent signal generator, a simple-looking oscillator when you do that. Your incandescent light bulb is generating a hell of a lot of energy at 500 nanometers, but it's doing it incoherently. It's just a pure black-body radiator because you've made it heat. You made it hot because of the current you're flowing through it, and it gives off that heat by glowing, so to speak. It's not a real radio oscillator. So when it comes to the highest frequency or the shortest wavelength, we got to be a little bit careful as to what we define as frequency and method of generation. You haven't got the whole answer, but you got at least a little bit of the beginning of it, Joe. WA2RYY, K2RYW.
Well, I guess that's what I was getting at, was what is the highest wavelength that can be, I guess, detected? And apparently that's, cosmic rays or gamma rays, whatever the highest one is. But is there a physical limitation on just because of like electron-proton structure just between those particles that you can get to a certain point and you just can't go anymore? That's I guess, the question I was sort of asking.
Just keep saying to yourself, no frequency is high enough, or no frequency is too high. There is no limit. The only limitation is, do you have enough energy? See, when you and I transmit a signal at 146 megahertz, we are using a zillion photons to do it. And each individual photon has very little energy. As I go higher in frequency, each individual photon has more energy. When I go to ultraviolet, near ultraviolet, each individual photon has enough energy that when it strikes my skin, it's capable of doing cellular damage. The mild form of that, you call it sunburn. And when you go further than that, it's a radiation burn. So as you go higher and higher, each individual photon has more energy. Eventually you get to the point where in order to go such a higher frequency, to generate one single photon, you may not have enough energy to do it today. But when you look at those gamma ray bursts that are going on in space, where you take all the energy that's put out by our sun in 10 billion years, and that gamma ray burst puts out that amount of energy in 1 second, is there a limit? Hell no. You got it, Joe.
I guess there's somebody else in there trying to get in also. Okay, that pretty much kind of answers that. Thank you for the answer.
Okay, you guys have heard TechNet number 1,232. Be kind to each other. We're essentially out of time. We're about to be cut off. Mel, put on those ribbons. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, I thought that the upper limit of what's so-called radio spectrum was 300 gigs. And then as we get into infrared, into terahertz, 1 terahertz and all, we're into some kind of light waves and all, you know, called the submillimeter bands and all. But I didn't consider that radio. I thought up the 300 gigs was what they call EHF. But all right, we'll talk about this next week. Thank you all. 73, good night.
The old days, Mel, 100 megacycles and above used to be considered microwave. Now you and I consider microwave 1 or 3 gigs and above. Light technique takes off at around 400 terahertz. That's where you begin infrared light techniques. The 2 terahertz signal, that's pure radio, and is far, far infrared. Most of the smart people will call that radio, not infrared. Bye-bye, you all. Think big. Think high frequencies. We'll see you next week.
K2RIW, K2J.
Hey, you sound good, and you were amazingly quiet tonight. You should have joined this crazy set of a discussion.
Yeah, no, I have my friend up from Florida. We're working on a high